We have with us today a great artist, Joshua Smith, flutist, who has really made a name for himself. Welcome to Crossover, Joshua.
Thank you.
And I didn't want to frighten you with that very impressive greeting, but you have really achieved a great deal since you were here. You were a Curtis student, is that right?
That's right.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
So, Curtis, and then what happened? This is going to be a kind of a homecoming for you, isn't it? Your appearances in the, well, certainly with the Chamber Music Society.
Right. I was in Philadelphia really briefly, actually. I came to Curtis when I was 17 and was there planning to, you know, go through my bachelor's degree, but got a job in Cleveland when I was a junior at Curtis. So
a job.
Yeah.
I think you should enlighten the audience. Quite a job.
Well, I was named the principal flutist of the Cleveland Orchestra.
And how old were you?
I was 20.
That's phenomenal. How did it happen? I mean, did you audition for it? Did you were you aiming for that? Obviously, you were. You did audition for it, but that was quite a step.
Yeah, I did. I did audition for it. To go a little bit farther back into the story in terms of how I was aiming for it, when I was 15, I think I was, I went off to, had sort of my first out of New Mexico experience as an artist and a musician. I went off to Tanglewood for the summer.
Wonderful. Yes.
And, I remember standing with my mouth hanging open at an open rehearsal of Bernstein conducting the BSO at Tanglewood, and just having this complete revelation. This is exactly what I want to do with my life. I want to be up there. I want to be sitting in the middle of an orchestra playing Brahms.
You had no idea that was where you would most likely, you know, wind up, because obviously not many flutists are soloists on that level.
Yeah, exactly. I probably had a lot more, like everyone does, a lot more experience listening to, you know, what I knew about flute at that point was from a pile of recordings of James Galway and,
right,
and Ron Paul. And so, but somehow the idea of being a flute soloist, even though I had these piles of recordings of Galway, didn't announce to myself as something that I was really all that interested in doing. And lo and behold, at Tanglewood, I found myself surrounded by this orchestral thing and just got completely excited by it. And so at 15, I was able to articulate to myself that that's really what I wanted to try to do. And I can even remember, this is really weird, but I remember very much on that day at that Brahms rehearsal saying, I want to be up there in 10 years. And without really understanding what that meant. And enough, it happened really quickly, actually.
I can see how that whole environment is so mesmerizing.
Right.
I mean, it's really, but you were very young. Your decisions for someone of that age are very, very specific, I think, because usually people are floundering around. Even if you are focused, you're floundering around until you're, you know, late teens, and then you decide. But this was really quite something. Now, you studied here at Curtis with whom?
Mostly with Julius Baker, the former principal flute in the New York Philharmonic, and also so he was the main teacher on the Curtis faculty, and then the faculty also had the addition of Jeffrey Kaner, who is now full on the faculty, and at that time was kind of sporadically coming in to assist Baker. And at that point, he was the principal flute in Cleveland, and I was in school when he decided that he was going to leave Cleveland to come to Philadelphia, and so that's the rest of the story. I went from Tanglewood back to high school, and I studied in Albuquerque. I was really, really happy with, I was incredibly lucky, actually, to be raised by an amazing, musically raised by an amazing, amazing teacher who just happened to live in New Mexico because he liked it there.
It's beautiful, Albuquerque.
Yeah, Frank Bowen was a fantastic teacher. So he got me through high school. I went to Curtis. I had Baker and Kaner, and to catch up with this little history, Jeff decided to move to Cleveland, and so from Cleveland to Philly, vacated the position in Cleveland
just in time for you.
Yeah, I think that they. The management in Cleveland, the Dohnányi then, and the decision makers, you know, listened to had a great list of sort of all of the obvious choices of experienced musicians who they mm-hmm. could invite to audition for Principal Flute, and they heard a bunch of them, and I think at some point Dohnányi just sort of, the story I've heard is that sort of off the cuff he said, well, is there anyone we haven't thought of, like any, you know, are there any kids out there who, you know, just might surprise us? And because of that, my name came up and I was invited, and he, you know, he liked it and decided to take this huge risk. And which became, you know,
was not a risk.
An amazing opportunity.
Wonderful. What do you play? I mean, what, for instance, for that particular a position of that caliber, what are the usual audition pieces?
Well, there's a long list of standard flute solos from the repertoire, from the orchestral repertoire, you know, everyone's used to seeing the same probably five things on a list like that, and then the list can have lots of other things too. But the main five things would be like the
syrinx.
I don't think I did play syrinx.
No.
So orchestral solos.
Oh yeah.
Daphnis and Chloe.
Oh yes, of course.
Afternoon of a Faun. Mm. The end of the Scherzo from Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm. The solo from the last movement of the Brahms Fourth Symphony, the solos from Leonore Third Overture mm-hmm. by Beethoven. Those are the kinds of things you can expect to always play if you're taking an orchestra audition.
Yes. Well, you know, that's very interesting altogether about the whole philosophy of orchestral playing, because there are instruments that also concentrate on solo work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I do remember all the concentration on the orchestral excerpts, and that's what was always for all the other instruments. And it is something, but you have certainly stepped out of the box. There's a lot of gorgeous flute music, sonatas, and also the music, the ensemble, you know, the chamber music work that you've been doing. So you've kind of stepped. You put one foot, I guess, you're still doing orchestral, you know, work, and then you have done a great deal of chamber music and also some solo work. So can we talk a little bit about Marlboro?
Yeah, Marlboro's great. Your question reminds me that I feel really lucky to be able to do all of this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't see myself as a straight up, you know, just solo career. I actually kind of think that would be boring because, when I go through the list on my hand of all of those things that I had to audition for the orchestra with, it includes Beethoven and Mendelssohn and Brahms, right? And mm-hmm. Ravel, and there isn't that much fantastic solo rep for the flutist by this canon of great composers.
Yes, yes.
I love what I am able to do as a soloist, but I also feel so fulfilled by the music and the kind of experiences that I've had within the orchestra. I think and chamber music is yet another realm. I mean, I just feel really excited by the fact that I'm doing all of this stuff. Marlboro is such a fantastic opportunity because there are so many things I love about it. If I had to pick, you know, what explains Marlboro in a nutshell, it's the concept that you have time to focus on what exactly it is that you love to do. It's a retreat where you are the people who go are handed a schedule, you know, once a week. These are the rehearsals that you'll have. These are the times that your meals will be prepared. And basically, you just live in this land of process, of really thinking carefully about how to build music from the inside. And that's what you do. You know, you just, you focus wholeheartedly on building and creating and showing up at dinner at the right time. And
but that's a very rare opportunity. Musicians don't have that wonderful exposure.
Well, the thing is, we never really have enough time in the real world.
So it's not the real world, yes.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it. I mean, or maybe Marlboro can be the real world, and everything else is not.
So well, that's utopia, real. I guess. Yeah,
exactly.
What a marvel! Now, in order to go there, are you auditioned for that as well?
Well, actually, there are sort of different realms of. The type of musician who goes. Everyone's great, and the how do I say this? Basically, how it's referred to at Marlboro is juniors and seniors. Mm-hmm. And the juniors audition to go. These are, you know, young, just pre-professional, budding young stars, let's call them. And the seniors are professional, you know, established musicians. And so the juniors audition to be involved in making music alongside the seniors, with the seniors.
Are you invited as a senior
yes.
to participate?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Seniors are invited and juniors audition?
Right.
I see. Mm-hmm. But that's very different from Tanglewood. I mean, it's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tanglewood's more, when I was there, it was more of a training institute, actually. And the nice thing about Marlboro is that everyone's learning from each other, and it's not like I'm a teacher and I'm working with students. I'm actually in chamber music groups alongside the quote-unquote juniors, and we're rehearsing in the way that I would be rehearsing with any colleague.
Now, I'm going to say something. As a harpist, you have stolen one of our most important works. We have a very limited repertoire, but you have kind of stolen the introduction and Allegro and made it your own with your beautiful flute playing.
Oh, well, thank you.
yeah, it's very beautiful. It's a beautiful work. Now, you will be performing here in Philadelphia, isn't that right?
Right.
And what is that going to be? Is that going to be, again, a soloist with ensemble?
That's a flute and piano recital, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, when is it? December 13th.
Yes.
And it's a straight up flute recital, actually. I think a great program. It's a program that has a theme, which I don't always do, but which can be really interesting and fun. If it doesn't end up being too sometimes programs look great on paper and they don't end up working. And I think this one really does because it has a journey. And thematically, it's all about literary treatment of unrequited love.
Uh-huh.
So all of the music is about yearning and emotional turbulence. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can do with that musically, and lot of emotion to dig into. So
what are you going to be playing?
Schumann. Romances, Debussy, both Syrinx that you mentioned, and also the a transcription of Afternoon of a Faun for flute and piano.
Wow.
Schubert's Variations on Trockenblumen, which is it's an amazing piece for Schubert. It's a hugely virtuosic piece for flute and piano. It's actually in the canon of If a pianist could pick a handful of some of the hardest chamber music pieces that he has to play or he or she has to play, this is on that list. And it's certainly not easy for the flutist either. And it's based upon, it's variations on one of Schubert's songs from the Die Schöne Müllerin cycle.
Yeah, okay.
And it's a song that really is about the exploration of death and
which he focuses on.
Yeah,
also
it's about making peace with finding peace in both death and the rebirth of spring, and being a set of variations, you get to sort of go through that emotional cycle over and over and over again. It's really a fantastic little piece. Well, little.
Well, yes, and a joy to play, yes.
So the rest of the program is Elliot Carter, a quick solo piece that's like 5 minutes long, Scrivo Invento by Elliot Carter. Now, no one would think of Carter as being a romantic composer in any way, but he definitely is an expressionistic composer, and this piece is based on Petrarch.
Yes.
Poetry about unrequited love. And it's kind of like listening in on someone's manic psychological
wanderings.
Yeah. It's pretty schizophrenic.
Wow.
And then the last piece is Reinicke Sonata. It's kind of one of our standard, really great pieces for flute and piano, and it's based on the Undine legend. And if you know Little Mermaid, you basically know who Undine is.
Yes.
A water sprite. Water sprite who wants to fall in love with a human and does, and then goes back to the water. And so anyway, the whole program sort of encapsulates romantic yearning, and it's been a lot of fun.
Who was the pianist again?
Her name is Christina Dahl. She's a great friend and a really fantastic pianist. She's an associate professor of piano at Stony Brook.
Yes.
And she happens to be married to one of my colleagues in the orchestra. So she divides her time between Cleveland and New York. And I just feel really lucky to work with her.
Well, I think you have an amazing approach to music. Very, very profound, of course. And you have received kudos from all over. Your reviews are amazing. Now, we have several releases here. Well, like the Bach, the flute sonatas you have. And then you have, of course, the Marlboro Music Festival recording.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the flute sonatas, you have two. Is that right?
Yeah. So I've now finished a full set of all of the Bach sonatas for flute.
How many are there?
Seven.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are spread over two CDs. And,
yes.
The second one came out about a year ago.
Yes.
First one about 2 years ago. So I was really busy with Bach for about 3 years.
Have you had enough?
No, I couldn't get enough. I wish there were more of them, actually. It's just a fantastic place to live, and that was a really great project. I also, before the Bach came out, a year before that, was Air, which is
all with
Viola
Harvey. Yolanda, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which was very beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, well, flute and harp is very nice.
Yeah.
That they belong together, I think. But so now your season in Cleveland is from when to when, and then what do you do in between?
Roughly, we're usually by the end of September starting up. You know, the fall season is like mid-September and September through May. And then our summer season is July and August. And those seasons are peppered always with a lot of traveling. The orchestra is doing a lot of outreach in many places, a ton of touring, actually. For example, in the winter, we have a 3 to 4 week residency in Miami at the Arst Performing Arts Center. So
yes.
I go to Miami quite regularly. And we're playing at, you know, festivals in Salzburg and Lucerne and Edinburgh in the summer, like every other summer, and in Vienna and Paris residencies in the fall. On the opposite years that we do the summer residencies, so we basically go to Europe every year. It's a lot of traveling. And Marlboro happens for me, it's working out to be about every other summer. I take some time off from our summer season here and do Marlboro then. And
obviously that is really, it's work, but it is a respite from all the other things.
It's just completely different from what I do.
Yeah.
It's just a huge luxury to be able to spend that much time preparing chamber music in such a beautiful place. And with the kind of quirky twist in Marlboro is that you're not necessarily there are no expectations to necessarily perform anything. You're kind of putting together music for the love of the process.
So it's kind of refreshing yourself. It's a regeneration, you know,
exactly.
Because you do get, no matter how much you love it and how much you work at it, it's not stale exactly, but you just need to approach it from a totally different viewpoint.
Right.
And I would imagine it is a retreat, as you say. Josh, are these your recordings, the two Bach and then the Marlborough Music Festival, or do you have anything else that you're planning to do?
So an air as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I have some thoughts about what might come next. But I think I decided to not do a recording this year because I did three straight years of recording releases, and I just needed to sort of back off a little bit. And that's a lot of work, actually.
Oh, it's enormous. That's why I'm wondering when you find the time, really,
yeah.
Essentially. And I mean, that's a kind of a hackneyed question, but you are, you know, completely full. And then the traveling, as you say, very, very exhausting.
Right. It's just a matter of sort of, you find time because you want to.
Well, and people probably want to hear you. You're on a very good label, the Delos
mm-hmm.
label, and well, a pleasure. And certainly, we look forward to hearing more from you and hearing you play as well.
Thank you.
So good luck, and I think you were also, I forgot to ask you, you were nominated for a Grammy. Is that right?
That was for Air. Yeah,
that was with the Viola.
Okay. Viola Harp record.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was exciting and completely unexpected.
Yeah. Well, anything that you want to do that you've kind of said, I'll do that, but not yet?
You know, Bach was that.
Ah.
And so now that having been done, I'm kind of playing around with a little bit more Baroque. I actually love Telemann. I'm playing around with the possibility of that, but I think the next record may be completely different from Bach. I might be going in a completely contemporary direction, actually.
Well, we could talk to you about that for another 20 minutes. But quickly, the Bach flute, I mean, was that the same flute that you're playing in terms of the range and so on? Were there any changes in the flute after then?
You mean specifically the instrument that Bach was writing for?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. The flute, when Bach wrote, it was barely, I think, two, three keys on the Baroque flute, mostly just holes, a completely different fingering system, a completely different sound, actually. The flute kind of came into being what it is now only in the end of the 1800s.
So, but the actual technique to play it and to produce the sounds that he wanted, is there a challenge in doing that on the contemporary flute, the modern flute?
Absolutely, yeah. It's not, you know, completely different. I mean, if you heard them alongside each other, if you heard someone play modern flute and someone play Baroque flute.
Well, you can't. Yes, the sound, of course.
They would sound very different. They're somewhat similar. They're both flutes, of course, but the approach is very different. And so I think it's important. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. You know, some people believe that Baroque music should only be played on authentic original instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand where that sense comes from, but I actually think it's somewhat more interesting to explore what stylistic things come up. You know, that what you're sort of exploring by asking that question is fascinating to me, to kind of play around with what do you learn about mm-hmm. how things could have been played or would have been played on an authentic instrument, and how can you apply those to the instrument that I play all the time.
Yes, it takes on a totally different personality as well.
Yeah.
So, well, that's another thing that you have to explore in your spare time, right?
Right, exactly.
Josh, thank you so much. So much to talk to you about, and I'm exhausted just listening to your schedule, but you are a great artist. You're a young one, and you have achieved so very, very much. Very, very proud to have you here.
Thank you.
Speaking with us on WRTI, and the best to you.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay.